This podcast is sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Medtronic. This episode is accredited for continuing medical education by CineMed. Please view the accreditation information in the show notes. After listening to the episode, click the link provided in the accreditation portion of the show notes to obtain your CME. It is with great pleasure that I am introducing our next guest on Reset Diabesity, Dr. Anthony Gonzalez. Dr. Anthony Gonzalez is the Chief of Surgery for Baptist Hospital. He had previously served as Vice Chief of Surgery. He is the Chairman of the Medical Surgical Performance Improvement Collaborative at Baptist Hospital and also serves as the Chair on various boards and steering committees. Dr. Gonzalez is the Medical Director of Bariatric Surgery at South Miami Hospital, and he is a member of multiple professional societies, including the American Society of Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery. Dr. Gonzalez's charity work and professional reputation have drawn surgeons from throughout Central and South America to travel to South Florida to learn from his expertise in bariatric and laparoscopic surgery. Dr. Gonzalez serves as the medical director for the Living Hope Haiti Christian Mission and performs pro bono surgeries in Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica. Dr. Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and tell me, how did you get into this specialization?
Yeah, so I'm a general and bariatric surgeon down in South Florida, Miami, Florida. I'm part of a large health system, 10 hospitals, 27,000 employees. And I got into this specialization because I love the breadth of taking care of all types of patients and all types of conditions. I love the variety of general surgery, which would include a hernia repair and a gallbladder surgery. I also can do bariatric surgery, and I can perform an operation to cure a metabolic condition like diabetes, or I can eliminate high blood pressure and sleep apnea with bariatric surgery. So obviously these are areas that interest me. For me, this is where I can provide the biggest benefit for a patient, and that's why I kind of have geared and directed my career into those areas.
In your residency, was there something particularly attractive about general surgery? Is that what opened that door for you?
I think it was even before residency. It was in medical school. In medical school, you know, you go through the rotations of medicine and you go through gynecology and you have a rotation in anesthesia and in pathology. General surgery, I love to work with my hands. I had always had good eye-hand coordination. I trained in an era where minimally invasive surgery was becoming very popular, and there was a big adoption of minimally invasive surgery in the mid-90s. And that eye-hand coordination was kind of like playing a video game. And I was pretty good in those days of video games. I'm not sure I can compete with the video games of today, but in those days, I was very good. And so I love to help patients. I love to solve problems. I don't take a lot of joy in just, you know, treating blood pressure forever, treating diabetes forever. I kind of wanted to take out an inflamed appendix or remove a cancer or repair a hernia and let people go on to their healthy lives. And so because of that, that really attracted me to general surgery.
Now, I noticed one of your early papers is reclosure of an open abdomen. You started with open procedures in your residency program and in medical school and in your residency program. That lasted for some time. That was right in that sweet spot when laparoscopic procedures were coming along. How early of an adopter were you in the laparoscopic? Were you sold as soon as you tried it?
Yeah, so I wasn't really an early adopter because that was in the late 80s, early 90s. I began a surgical career in the mid 90s, 1994. But it was early on. I mean, we were just doing gallbladders. We were kind of fumbling upon inguinal hernias. Ventral hernias were not even done. People were trying to explore, let's say, foregut and colorectal and things like that were in the early 90s. In reference to that paper, that is a publication where we were able to demonstrate that even patients who had catastrophic traumatic events and ended up with what we called an open abdomen, we could go back into their abdomen and repair these hernias. And, you know, these hernias were not amenable to minimally invasive approaches, but they could actually be performed in these hostile abdomens that we thought previously could never either ever be entered. We were able to enter them and demonstrate and communicate and educate our co-surgeons around the world that this was possible.
And that's very interesting. It's being in that position where you're working on patients that are difficult to work on. What changed in terms of patient care and procedures that let you do procedures that weren't possible to do before?
Yeah, I think a lot of things have changed. Number one is the advancement in minimally invasive surgery, laparoscopy, you know, no doubt advanced with advanced energy, with laparoscopic stapling. And then, you know, obviously with the onset of robotic surgery, you know, my adoption was very early on in robotic surgery in my world of general surgery. And so I think the addition of robotic surgery, 3D vision, wristed instrumentation, all the advanced energy that robotic surgery provides, and what we call the smart stapling, all of that allowed us to do these operations that were not possible, even laparoscopically, we're able to do them robotically.
Well, I do want to talk to you about advancements in robotic procedures. I've been reading your work on using robotic systems in the procedures themselves and patient outcomes. And so I do want to get into patient outcomes and the differences between the robotic and the more traditional laparoscopic methods. Let's talk a little bit about obesity in general. Now, my understanding is that the metabolic disease of obesity will reach roughly 50% of the U.S. population by 2030. And I believe that came from the CDC, if I'm not mistaken. Does that seem to be in line with what you're finding in your practice?
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, we see obesity in all aspects of my practice. Of course, we see it in the bariatric world with the bariatric patients, but we see it in the general surgery world. We have patients who come in for all types of problems, whether it be a hernia or a gallbladder or a lipoma, a lump or a bump. You know, there's just more preponderance of obesity. And, you know, that's multifactorial. We're seeing it in children and adolescents. You know, the days of where maybe you and I used to, you know, go out and ride our bike and play in the street. Now the kids are on computers and tablets, and there's more connection via the internet and through non-personal manners than there is in a there is personally. You know, used to be able to see your friends, you have to go to their house or get together at a park. Nowadays, you can connect on a chat and everybody can hang out from the comfort of their home and their bed and connect with friends. So that has also contributed to the amount of obesity that we're seeing in young adults and of course, into adulthood.
Is there, in addition to some lifestyle factors, is there anything about diet that has changed drastically in the last 30 years that's contributed to this?
Yeah, there's no doubt that the supersize era has definitely contributed to it. You know, when you compare what you used to get at a fast food restaurant for a burger, a fry, and a drink, and you compare that to today, you know, probably has tripled or quadrupled in size. You're getting it. So, you know, the diet is the number one factor that impacts obesity, and you know, there are genetic portions, there are hormonal components, and there are behavioral and exercise as well. But, you know, it is what you eat and what you consume. So diet is very, very important. And the way that our world and our country has turned into more processed foods, and people are not shopping on what we people describe as the perimeter of the grocery store and more on the central portion of the grocery store with canned products as opposed to fresh fruits and vegetables and fresh meats and chickens and fishes, you're going to see more obesity because of that.
Is there what are the underlying mechanisms that are contributing to this? There's some lifestyle factors, there's some dietary factors, there's something going on metabolically as well.
Yeah, obviously, no doubt the lifestyle, the dietary, it could be the socioeconomic factors. No doubt that better food that's healthier is more expensive. You can just go to your local fried chicken fast food restaurant and order a bucket of fried chicken with some mashed potatoes, and you could feed the family. You can order your local pizza place, and there's also always deals. And so the finances play a big role in that, as well as families who are struggling financially are trying to feed their family. So, that is a definite factor. And then whether or not our environment is impacting, the hormonal factors, we know that environment impacts our cancer risk. Could it impact our hormones and impact our ability to process foods? Are the microbes in our intestines changed and food is processed differently because of that? There are a lot of factors that we don't completely understand, but it is multifactorial for sure.
Well, it's interesting. I've had some conversations with folks about socioeconomic status and food deserts and sort of the environmental conditions. It's interesting. It's interesting to hear you bring that up, because that's usually not something that someone has brought up to me in the past. It's been the other way around. What do you think is contributing overall? Is it just the confluence of all of these things? Is it something in particular that's leapt out at you?
No, I think it's a combination of all these factors. I think it's a combination of a marketing, what industry has fed our children, visually fed our children, the combination of the supersized and the bigger meals, the all you can eats, and then the internet, and the fact that nowadays the youngsters are not playing in the streets and on bicycles, maybe the unsafe neighborhoods and the fear of the parents to allow their kids to be on the street and to roam. And then, are we walking? I mean, I think the U.S. has one of the highest obesity rates in the world. And when you travel to, Europe and you travel to other countries, people are walking in the streets, and the mode of transportation could be bicycle as opposed to here. It's all automobile, fast transit. And so there's not as much of that activity. So I believe it's a multitude of factors that are contributing to the growing obesity epidemic in our country.
I'm going to shift gears a little bit. What can you explain to me a patient's journey from however they access healthcare to finding you? How do they get to you?
Yeah, so I think even before a patient, wants to seek out me or another bariatric surgeon, they have to determine that they have a problem, that obesity is impacting them medically, socially, psychologically, to such an extent that they're willing to take this drastic step. Usually patients spend a couple years, literally the data shows 2 to 3 years investigating, searching, thinking, researching if they would like to have bariatric surgery and then with whom. Obviously when they really want to kind of, let's say, pull that trigger, they would communicate with our program, communicate with our office. They would attend an information seminar. An information seminar is like a 1-hour lecture, which myself as the surgeon provides to them, tells them how obesity impacts their life, how obesity can shorten their life, what are the implications of being obese, high blood pressure, diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, heart disease, increased cancer risk. And then what are the options? What are the medical options? What are the surgical options? And then we go into surgery and we describe the surgical procedures, the benefits and the risks of the surgical procedures. And then my team would talk about what we call next steps and, you know, what you need to do to be able to see Dr. Gonzalez in the office and eventually have surgery. So it's not a simple journey. It's a different path than somebody who has a hernia or a gallbladder and wants to see me and wants to have surgery. But it's something that the patient has to really, really take a lot of time and a lot of effort in regard to consideration if this is what they would like to proceed with.
I know that for myself, I had a SADIE, and that procedure was Dr. Sharp at UNC Rex. To get to that place took me a few years. And one of the things I struggled with was I was busy managing all of my comorbidities. My diabetes, my cataracts, you name it, I had it except for cancer, thank God. But I had come to the conclusion that being obese was for me was a death sentence. And I'm wondering, people have said, well, it takes work, it takes persistence, it takes will. It also takes a certain amount of desperation. I want to see my grandkids. I want to see him get married. I want to see him graduate school. I want to be around for that. How would you get primary care physicians to see beyond comorbidities and start talking about obesity with their patients? There was no soft entry for me. It was either avoided or confronted head on. What are your patients saying?
Yeah, it's difficult. It really depends on the primary physician. I think and nowadays, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years, so it's different. Bariatric surgery is more accepted now. Bariatric surgery is more understood by the referring physician, the primary physician, the cardiologist, the orthopedic surgeon. So I think it's a bit different this era. And I think, you know, the primary physician today is intelligent enough to understand that the underlying problem to the high blood pressure, the hypercholesterolemia, and the diabetes is the obesity. And if they can solve that obesity. But, you know, they previously, number one, treatment of obesity takes a lot of effort. And primary physicians are really driven by volumes and seeing patients and they're pressed for time and to discuss with the patient. How do you deal with obesity? What's a healthy lifestyle? Diet modifications, you know, exercises. It takes time. It's probably easier to refill all their medications and send them on their way. So I think it, you know, it's not only the primary physician. There has to be other resources. There has to be other personnel that can support the primary physician who has the time to spend with that patient. And let's say coach that patient along the way. And obesity is not a problem that's going to be solved in one day. It's a very complex medical condition. It's as we eloquently covered, it's multifactorial, the causes. You have to kind of get down to the root cause. What is your particular issue? And then it has to be treated as a chronic condition. Obesity is not a curable condition. It's a chronic condition that needs to be treated. So it means ongoing care. And sometimes the primary physicians can't provide the care that the patient needs. These patients need weekly evaluations, weekly check-ins. They need accountability by somebody. So it is very, very difficult. I think it's a very difficult endeavor that we're requesting that a primary physician accomplish. And I think it requires much more than just a primary physician to really help the patient get on track and begin that journey.
Now, I know that your practice is a multidisciplinary practice. It features a lot of the treatment options around obesity, and there are lots of avenues that it takes with nutrition, with diet, with exercise. Is there a role for something, and I don't know that this exists, but something like a hospitalist to help get patients from sort of their entry to you? And then once a patient gets to you, how much of the total patient care do you take over from the primary care physicians, or does it go back to them?
Yeah, I think your term of a hospitalist would be maybe a medical bariatrician. So if a patient believes that they have that obesity is a problem in their life, or the primary physician has convinced them of that, they would come to this hospitalist, as you would describe. That would be my medical bariatrics team. And the medical bariatrics team would evaluate the patient and say, you know what, you know, we could begin with medical therapy, but your BMI is 50, 60, and no medical therapy is going to solve your problems. And so, you know, you probably need to go see Dr. Gonzalez and have bariatric surgery. If the patient's fearful, we can begin on medical therapy, and they would begin the process and would navigate nutritionists, behavioral therapists, all the components that the patient needs to try to become successful. Then, you know, if and when the patient decides wants to have bariatric surgery, then, you know, the patient would come to me. I would evaluate the patient for bariatric surgery, make sure they are a candidate, and then discuss the procedure. But I only take care of the patient in the acute setting for bariatric surgery. And then we do follow the patient long-term with regard to their bariatric surgery outcomes, make sure they don't regain weight, make sure they've maintained their weight loss, make sure they've reached their goals, and any deficiencies that the bariatric procedure can cause. I do not manage their diabetes, their high blood pressure, whether they need to come off their medication for their diabetes, whether their CPAP is no longer needed for their sleep apnea. Those are managed by their primary physician, their endocrinologist, their pulmonologist, any other of those other specialties.
Within your practice, would you tell us a little bit more about your practice? What are the roles, and how are they involved in the process? It sounds like they have a fairly broad portfolio in support of your work.
Yes. So, you know, you have everyone from a coordinator who kind of receives the patient and determines whether the patient would like to go to the medical arm or the surgical arm. If the patient wants surgical arm, then the patient will proceed into the bariatric information seminar and then subsequently end up in a path to have insurance verification and see me in the office and begin the journey of possible bariatric surgery. Along that pathway, they have to see their primary physician. They have to see a mental health counselor, psychologist, psychiatrist. They have to see a nutritionist and any other subspecialties that I deem could be necessary to make sure that we have a successful outcome in the bariatric surgery. If they decide they would like to go through the medical arm, then they're referred in our medical weight loss program. They'll see our medical bariatrician, our APPs, our physician's assistants that help out with that, and who will educate the patients about correct eating, exercise. They'll be referred to nutritionists and mental health counselors as needed in that realm. More nutritionists than mental health counselors if they feel that they need, you know, mental health counseling with regard to adoption of an alternative eating habit, if they feel that, you know, the limited eating is going to be an issue with possible addiction transfer, they have to be seeing a mental health counselor. And so that's managed in that area. So yeah, there's a lot of support. You do need all these type of clerical personnel, like coordinators and navigators. I haven't even begun to tell you about the people that navigate them. Between the time that they see me in the office and eventually have bariatric surgery, it could be 6 to 9 months. In that process, they're navigating medical necessity letters, nutritional counseling, psychological evaluation, all of these. So, you know, these are facilitated and assisted by navigators that we have in our program.
That's really interesting. Are there, for me, when I moved from North Carolina to Houston, I continued care through Dr. Matar, and so he's my current bariatric physician. Two things I found. One is insurance is a mess. I'm not sure if that's universal, but it seems universal to me. But that might be the bias of my own world, my own experience. How are your patients managing the insurance process?
Patients manage insurance very difficult. In the medical arm, if you can see them for another condition, diabetes or high blood pressure, you may get coverage in that area. It gets a little tricky because, you know, if their primary physician is already managing those, we're not primary doctors. So, you know, that is something that is a little bit more difficult. And in bariatric surgery, as you know very well, coverage has been difficult depending on the state, depending on the plan. And then in those plans, you even have what we call sub plans. We have networks. They love to you know, note them as quality networks, but they have nothing to do with quality. They all have to do with cost. And so what insurance plans try to figure out is who can provide the cheapest bariatric surgery, not the best bariatric surgery, the cheapest. And so you may be included or excluded from a plan or a network based on your cost. So not only do you have to have coverage, but you also have to determine if you have a network that you are required to participate in as a participant, as a patient, and then seek out that type of network and that provider. And it may not be who you chose. It may not be the one you want to have surgery with, but it may be the one that your insurance company has a contract with. And, it, you know, not all the time is it the premier program, because quality care costs money. And so, you know, at Baptist Health, you know, we do provide the utmost highest quality of care, but it does cost money to provide that type of quality care. And so we're looking at providing value to the patient, value, which is quality over cost.
Now, I understand with a number of practices that of patients who are eligible for surgery, a very small percentage actually make it to an operating room, and that there's quite a bit of attrition between walking in the front door and actually getting a procedure. I don't know if you've seen that to be true, and if that is related to the individual or to costs or to a variety of other factors. What's your experience?
Yeah, so we track that very closely in our program, and that's what is described as the conversion rate. So what is the rate of conversion of somebody who comes to an information seminar and eventually makes it to the operating room? And so for your reference, national rates of conversion could be 15, 19%, 23%. And we're in the upwards of 30% in our program. And, you know, not everybody will make it to the operating room. Why? Because number one, not everybody needs bariatric surgery. There are patients who I see in my office who are not candidates for bariatric surgery. Either A, their BMI is not high enough, B, their medical conditions are prohibitive, or C, they're just not mentally ready to have bariatric surgery. So there are patients that are just not candidates. You have patients who don't have insurance coverage and they don't have the finances to pay for it, you know, as a self-pay, so they won't make it. And then you have those patients that do have insurance coverage, do qualify, but despite the navigation, they don't have the persistence. They don't have the compliance required to complete all the requirements that are necessary from their insurance company. And so they never end up in the operating room. And so, you know, there's a variety of reasons why patients never end up in the operating room. I don't think every patient should or could end up in the operating room, but I think that, you know, it has to be somebody who is ready and willing to have bariatric surgery and who is kind of dedicated and committed to completing the steps and the tasks necessary to obtain insurance authorization.
It's interesting. One thing I found very compelling was the conversation about diabetes. And it was when I was diagnosed, it was there's no real treatment except bariatric surgery. Otherwise, you're just on medication for the rest of your life. And that was a fairly stark moment. I'm wondering if those sort of, that kind of abrupt moment is part of the process, if that doesn't help patients think about kind of what their next step is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of times that is what kind of is the trigger that kind of sparks people to have bariatric surgery. It could be even pre-diabetes. They come to me because their hemoglobin A1C is maybe 6, and their doctor's telling them, "I'm going to start putting you on medication. You need to lose weight. Have you considered bariatric surgery?" And some of them, they're already on diabetes. But other times, it could be even a heart attack. A heart attack could be the one that changed their life. I've seen, heart disease and cardiac events be the one that changes their life and makes them, kind of seek bariatric surgery. But yeah, I mean, diabetes is a scary disease, and because it's not curable, and because of the end organ impact, and the fact that it impacts, as you mentioned, your eyes and your kidneys and your heart and your brain and the circulation of your feet, so many other parts of your body that patients understand that and they're fearful. I had a patient the other day who came for bariatric surgery, and in the questioning, "Are you diabetic?" "No." And "But why are you wearing this sensor on your arm?" "Because I'm so scared to be diabetic that I had my doctor prescribe it to me so I could put it on. But I'm coming to you before I'm diabetic." So yeah, people are scared of it. People are scared of diabetes, which is, I guess, a good thing to be scared of it, because at least it's driving them in the right direction.
Let's talk a little bit about patient outcomes, about procedural safety, and about why one over the other. What do you look for when you make a recommendation about a bariatric surgery? And how does that lead to one procedure over another?
I think that the patient at the end of the day is going to have the final decision. I try to influence the patient with my recommendations, but a couple of things we look at is, number one, we look at their BMI. And a lower BMI, what I call a lower BMI, 35, 40, 45, is going to be amenable to any operation, right? Those low BMIs are going to be successful with a sleeve, they're going to be successful with a gastric bypass. Once your BMI gets into the 50s and 60s, then you start, disqualifying yourself as a sleeve patient. And I explain to patients, it's all mathematical. The sleeve helps the patient lose 60 to 65% of their excess weight. So in simple terms, if your BMI is 60, you're 200 pounds of weight, you're gonna lose 120 pounds, 130 pounds. You're still 70, 80 pounds overweight. So mathematically, it just doesn't make sense with a BMI of 60. So BMI is one of the factors. Number two is diabetes. We know that the gastric bypass is the better operation for diabetes. So, somebody who's been diabetic with insulin, diabetes over 5 years, I'm pushing them to bypass. Higher BMIs, diabetics, I push them to bypass. Lower BMIs, non-diabetics, I'm okay with a sleeve. But if a BMI 40, no diabetes, no high blood pressure, wants a gastric bypass, I'm not talking them out of the gastric bypass. It's the best operation. It's going to give you the most amount of weight loss, and it's going to give you the lowest chance of weight regain, which we talked about earlier.
And for a procedure like the SAEDI that I had, what would be the variables that might push you towards a SAEDI?
Yeah, so I think, again, it's very, SAEDI, very similar to a gastric bypass. I think, higher BMI, diabetes, those are where it would push you over to a SAEDI.
And that was my case. My BMI was over 50, and I've lost about 200 pounds, actually, so since the procedure. What is the what's the outcome like? How safe is the procedure today?
Yeah, thank God for the advancement in minimally invasive surgery, technology, industry, robotic surgery. These operations are very, very safe. The days of patients spending 5 days in the hospital, people dying of bariatric surgery, that is long gone. And so we have a lot of data. Bariatric surgery, gastric bypass is as safe as a gallbladder operation. So as we know, gallbladder surgeries are everyday operations. No primary physician would ever, just even think twice about sending their patient for a gallbladder surgery, but they worried about bariatric surgery because of the risk. Well, they have to understand that these risks are similar to gallbladder surgery, similar to hysterectomy, hernia repair. So these operations are very safe. Infection rates, VTE, DVTs, very low, and mortality is like literally non-existent with bariatric surgery. The other side of outcome is weight loss, and these operations do great in regard to weight loss. You know, as I mentioned, sleeve, 60 to 65% of excess body weight loss, bypass, 75, 80% of excess body weight loss, you know, resolution of high blood pressure, diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, sleep apnea, reducing cancer risk back to normal within 2 years, you know, longevity of life, long-term 20-year studies done showing that, you know, giving patients back 8 to 13 years of life that they've lost for being obese. So, you know, these operations overall are very safe and could be very beneficial for the patient.
For my procedure, there was a pretty good period of time at the beginning where I actually had to modify my diet and lose weight. I have heard varying opinions about how much process should be involved in the early stages of treatment. What is your sense of that? I know that the society has some recommendations on that. Where are you at with that?
And you're talking about changing your diet before surgery or after surgery?
Before surgery.
Yeah, in our program, we're very committed to preoperative, very low carbohydrate liquid protein diet. There's good data to show that that shrinks the liver and decreases blood loss. So we educate and we impose on all our patients this pre-op diet for 2 weeks. We don't have a requirement of preoperative weight loss, like, you know, with the exception of a patient that may not pick the best operation. Like, you know, we have patients who want a sleeve gastrectomy, but they're really a gastric bypass patient because that's really what the operation they need. So I tell them, you know what, if you really want to have a sleeve, you got to make yourself more of a sleeve candidate. That means you need to lose some weight before surgery. So those patients, I would tell them, hey, probably a good idea to lose some weight so you're a better sleeve candidate. But the everyday patient doesn't require weight loss before surgery. Now, when they are on this very low carbohydrate liquid protein diet, they're going to lose some weight. And so that's just going to come, you know, as a benefit of the diet, but that's not necessary.
In my experience, well, my limited experience, it was a question of fatty liver and reducing that to a certain extent. And part of it was coupled with the weight loss. For me, it helped establish a pattern of accountability. And I personally found that useful, but not all the people in my cohort did. Some of them were put off by the prospect. I wonder what kind, in interacting with your patients, what kind of commitment you're looking for from them. I mean, there's some trigger, right? Some variable that's telling you this person's a good candidate. What is that?
Yeah, I think it's a multitude of factors. Number one, you know, we have a nicotine-free program. So if a patient cannot stop smoking to have bariatric surgery, and we test them for nicotine twice before surgery, I mean, you're not committed. You're not committed. So it's for the patient's safety. We're not here just to do bariatric surgery, just to do operations. We're here for the patient's health. And perioperatively, around the time of surgery, the complications are much higher if you're smoking. After surgery, smoking is a no-no for bariatric surgery because of the complications that can happen. So if you can't stop smoking, if you can't complete your nutritional visits and see the nutritionist, you know, every month for 3 months or 6 months, how am I going to expect for you to follow up with me for 5 years at least to maintain weight loss, to make sure you don't regain weight, to make sure that your vitamin levels are adequate? How am I going to be sure of that? So I do need to see that level of commitment from the patient to be able to offer them bariatric surgery. If not, you know, we're wasting our time. We're going to have a high failure rate. We're going to have unnecessary complications after surgery. I don't want that, and no patient should want that.
What is What is the failure rate among patients who go through the surgery? What does that look like?
So failure rates depend on the type of operation. You know, historically, you can take an operation like a vertical banded gastroplasty, which is no longer done, who had failure rates up in the 60%. We had the laparoscopic adjustable band, very popular in our country. And the laparoscopic adjustable band, because 90% of the success was dependent on the patient showing up into the office to get an adjustment, that failure rate was in the upwards of 40 to 50%. But both of those operations are obsolete today. And so in today's operations, the sleeve gastrectomy has a 10 to 20% failure rate, and the gastric bypass, you know, pretty much the gold standard in our country, it has a 5 to 10% failure rate. So I think, you know, the operation choice and the patient choice both impact failure rates. But, you know, even in the perfect patient, you know, these operations do have a failure rate. And an interesting question is always asked, you know, is it the operation that fails the patient, or is it the patient that fails the operation? And we're really never going to know that, because you never check operations to see if they failed on patients who are successful. You always check an operation to see if it's failed on a patient who was unsuccessful. And so it's difficult to know where the failure lies. And so many of times you see patients who regain weight, you check the surgery, surgery's intact. It looks like I did it yesterday. And so it's the patient who failed the operation, but not the operation failing the patient. And there are occasions that the operations, you know, as well fail the patient. And then that's when you may consider revisional bariatric surgery for that type of patient.
Is there are you seeing patients at an increasingly younger age these days?
Well, we've dealt with adolescents really historically in our program. We've been operating on patients as young as 14 years of age. I operate on patients as young as 14 and as young as 80, you know, because those are the extremes of age that I've done in 30 years. But adolescence is something that is more complex. You know, you have to have involvement of the family, the parents, and I think it's been steady. I think the not that we're seeing more adolescents today than we saw 5 years ago. It's just been, there's always been a steady trickle of adolescents. It is fewer, the number of, obviously much fewer, the number of adolescents, and what I call adolescents, 14 to 18 years of age, that we're doing. But the overall bariatric patient in general is going to be a woman, and it's going to be a young woman, 20, 30, 40 years of age. That's the majority of bariatric surgical patients.
Is there a patient who's too young for surgery, and is there a patient that's too old for surgery?
Yeah, I think young, it, no doubt, probably in our program under 14 is in our program. That has to do with not only bone maturity, but mental health and mental maturity. But there could be 16 and 18 year olds that are too young. When I interview them, they're just not ready mentally. And though the mother or the father wants them to have surgery, that patient has to live with their surgery for the rest of their life. So I think that, you know, there's a chronological minimum, but there's also a mental minimum as well. And in regard to the other extreme, it's not necessarily the young age of 80, but there are patients that are prohibitive risk at 60 or at 70 because they have comorbidities that are just too profound. And I tell them, I'm sorry, you should have come to see me 5 years ago. Maybe at 5 years ago, you would have had an opportunity. You know, severe cardiac disease, morbid obesity with a severe cardiac or respiratory. Patients were on home oxygen. You know, those patients, you know, they'll never get off the ventilator. They'll be intubated. They'll be trached. So, you know, there are comorbidities that are just prohibitive and that that make the patient really too old for bariatric surgery.
And that's physical age. That's not actually the number. It's the physical age of, okay. That makes sense. I'm wondering about the long-term cost as well. I mean, I want to ask you about insurance and why insurance is being so short-sighted about this. And then I also want to ask about some of the costs, for me anyway, are the lifetime of vitamins. The diet itself is more expensive than a junk diet would be. In my case, I still drink protein drinks to make up a delta. And I do that pretty frequently. Those aren't cheap. I like my protein to come in well over 100 grams a day. And so I'm constantly working on that. But I have found that to be expensive. I don't know if where you're at with the costs and what your experience has been.
Yeah, so first with insurance, I mean, the insurance companies are short-sighted. And the data shows that most participants and most patients will stay with insurance for 2 to 3 years and they change. Either the employer changes or they change employers. And so for an insurance company to kind of reap the benefits of bariatric surgery financially, they need 3 to 4 years to pay back the cost of the healthcare for that patient, the cost of the medications for that patient. So financially, it really doesn't make sense for an insurance company to pay for it. Now, on the other hand, now we have all these very expensive medications, which some insurance companies are covering, and they're realizing, wow, that's very expensive to cover that long term. Because, as I mentioned earlier, obesity is not a curable condition, it's a controllable condition, and you have to be on these medications long term. So, insurance companies are realizing, wow, a year of these medications is more expensive than bariatric surgery. So, let's cover bariatric surgery instead of providing these medications for these patients. So, there's a cost to the insurance company, and then there's a cost to the patient. So, what I tell patients are there's a cost of you being out of work because you're ill, there's a cost of you being out of work to attend and go to medical visits. There's a cost for your co-payments and for your medications. And there's a social, economic, social psychological cost. What is the cost of your depression and your anxiety and your self-esteem that you've lost because of your obesity? What is that price for you? Does it impact you economically? Can you not be promoted in your workplace because of obesity and the way you look? Is it limiting your productivity, your energy, and your ability to be productive in your workplace or in your life as a whole? So you have to kind of factor all that in. And so nothing is free. There's a price you're paying for your diabetes, for your high blood pressure, for your sleep apnea and the lack of sleep that you have and the hypersomnolence that you have throughout the day. And the lot and the work hours and the work days lost. So yeah, it's a price you pay for bariatric surgery and the better food that you have to consume and the vitamins that cost money, but that's offset by everything else that you're not losing or not paying for when you had these medical conditions or this chronic medical condition called obesity.
And I found that just sleeping is vastly different. The lack of a CPAP has made the world a better place. It's miraculous how much of a difference that makes.
And you can't underestimate the value of the way you feel. The value, I mean, what is the price tag on your self-esteem? What is the price tag on your just your the psychological impact of what obesity does to you and not being obese, how that changes your perspective in life? How could you put a price tag on that?
Well, it's funny. I was when I was coming back to the U.S. I went through passport control, and they looked at my photo and they said, "You've lost a lot of weight." And it's an old photo. I said, "I have." I said, "How did you do it?" And when I said I had bariatric surgery, I almost felt as if I almost felt guilty for having had bariatric surgery. I can't really explain it. It felt like somehow embarrassing in some way. I couldn't articulate what that discomfort was. I don't know if you run into that with your patients as they're trying to navigate. Life is a skinny person is vastly different. What kind of feedback are you getting from your folks?
Yeah, I think the majority of patients are very happy to publicize and discuss the fact that bariatric surgery has changed their life. You will find a rare patient that doesn't want that disclosed or doesn't want to disclose that or is very secretive about it. But in general, patients are they're very, very thankful. They're very, very appreciative of what bariatric surgery has done in their life. And the reason I know that is because they send me other patients. I was sent here by Melissa. I was sent here by John. You did their bariatric surgery. That's my neighbor. That's my coworker. And so people in general don't have a problem because they want to help others. They understand the trouble they've been through. They understand the struggles. They understand at that level of obesity that we're talking about, bariatric surgery level of obesity, you and I know that there's no other solution for that. Medication is not going to solve 100, 150 pounds of weight loss. And so they want to help those that are struggling as well and try to help them find a solution just like they were able to find it.
I do feel sort of evangelistic about it myself. It was very weird feeling ill at ease confronting that, but it was, at a border control site. So could have been a variety of factors. For me, it was my wife. My wife lived through a duodenal switch and watching her recover and manage her obesity was inspirational. It got me to rethink everything about myself and my health and the future. Do you have couples come to you?
Yeah, couples, families are very, very common. That's why we believe that, it could be genetic. Also, could it be behavioral? There have been studies to show that, a lot of individuals, when they immigrate from, let's say the eastern part of the world to the western part, obesity is more common in this side and than they were in their families on the eastern side. So families are very, very common. I do get couples all the time. What I usually see is that the woman is usually the first person that's usually steps up, as was in your case. And I, in general, don't allow to, I don't, when they come together, like they want to do it together, they come at the same time, same appointment and everything else, and they want to be in the journey together. I try to separate them by a couple of weeks because I want one to care for the other. And then on occasion, you will see them not come together. And then the wife would have been done 3 years ago and she brings her husband because now he finally has decided that he wants to do something about his obesity and they'll bring him. So yeah, no doubt about it. I see all types of families. I see a lot of father daughters, mother sons, things like that as well, that they will come together as well to be seen in the office.
Have you seen outcome data, patient outcome data related to family support? So those families that do seek treatment together, what is their likelihood of outcome vice families that don't? And I'm just wondering off the top of my head here.
So. Yeah, so I don't know of any particular, let's say, spouse data that, if they do it together as opposed to a person that does it without their spouse, I don't know. But there's no doubt that support of family is very, very important. The support of the family is of utmost importance because if you have a patient who has bariatric surgery and when they return home, they're sabotaged by their family, they're not cooperative. That's not going to produce a good outcome. That's going to produce more problems in the family. They could produce problems in the marriage. So there has to be family support, whether it's an adolescent that's supported by their parents, or it's an adult supported by their partner or their spouse. There should be support at all levels to have good outcomes. There's no doubt that would lead to better outcomes in patients.
Well, I wonder, I haven't seen I haven't seen much research in that area, and I was trying to imagine myself if I were to come home and my family was not involved, how difficult the journey would be. I really can't imagine how hard it is without family support.
Yeah, no, that's why I mentioned that, you know, if you're coming home and you have bariatric surgery and your spouse is not obese and obesity is not a problem, or their spouse is obese and really doesn't care, when they're providing all the cookies and all the junk food and all the chips and all the sodas and all the sugary drinks, and they're not helping you with your behavioral problem or your addiction that you have, then it cannot be good. It won't be good. It's going to lead to either failure in your bariatric patient, or it's going to lead to problems in that home, because, you know, the bariatric patient may have to leave that house to be able to be successful.
Don't doubt it. I know that people will find a way if they're predisposed to do so. I wonder, what is the state of behavioral therapies, behavioral or cognitive therapies that might be effective for postoperative care? Are you seeing that some mental health treatment is more effective, less effective, different at all?
I think that the treatment after surgery really begins before surgery. It's identifying the patients before surgery, screening them to make sure they don't have any potential for addiction transfer, making sure that they are ready mentally, socially, psychologically to undergo the changes of bariatric surgery. I think you have to evaluate the social environment where the patient is. Is the environment conducive to bariatric surgery as well? And I think that will help deal with a lot that what could happen postoperatively. And I think the patient, you know, obviously should continue to seek at least ongoing discussions and evaluations by the mental health counselors postoperatively to make sure they're dealing with the adjustments that are occurring. Because, you know, food is a very important portion of pretty much everybody's life. You know, if you're dealing with the stress, if you used to eat before, you can't eat. How are you dealing with that? How are you managing those stresses? And that should be, you know, discussed with a professional to ensure that there is no addiction transfer. The worst thing in the world is somebody who, you know, used to be obese. Now they've lost the weight and they've begun smoking or drug addiction, alcoholism. You know, we haven't helped the patient by doing that. We've removed one chronic medical condition, but we've added another one. And so, you know, we have to make sure of that even before surgery and try to identify those patients before surgery to prevent it postoperatively.
Is that a big subset of the population that receives help, the people struggling with addictions?
Well, everybody has to see a mental health counselor, a psychologist, psychiatrist before surgery. You know, it really depends on the individual on whether they're going to need ongoing assistance for that help. And that'll be really an individual situation. But, you know, as we know more and more in our community, in our world, in our country, mental health diseases are more prevalent. Could be the stresses of our environment. It could be, you know, recent pandemics. Who knows? Could be the isolation, not only that has occurred in our pandemic, but the isolation that occurs today in youngsters because of the lack of interaction. Could it be social media and what people perceive to be other people's reality, which it isn't? So there's a lot of factors, but I think that patients, you know, 100% need to be seen and evaluated prior to surgery for the risk of mental health conditions, and then ongoing postoperatively to deal with anything that they may have afterwards, and make sure to keep that in line, because, you know, obesity is a behavioral problem, and no doubt that, you know, the mind is very, very strong in that fight for obesity. So we never want to disrupt the relationship that the patient would have with a psychologist or psychiatrist who is capable of doing a thorough preoperative evaluation for bariatric surgery. Today, things have changed drastically. In the, let's say, in the old days, 20 years ago, there were no standard testing or evaluation for bariatric surgery, psychological testing. But today there are. And so as long as their provider, who knows them best, their provider is going to know them much better than, you know, that I sent them to my Dr. Smith psychiatrist or psychologist. So I always honor their provider first, and ensure that their provider is capable of providing that thorough preoperative psychological evaluation for bariatric surgery. If they don't have one, they don't see a psychologist or psychiatrist, then we do have a small group of psychologists and psychiatrists who are capable of evaluating patients preoperatively and screening them and providing the tools and the evaluation tools so that they can be determine whether or not they are ready. And then on occasion, we'll have one a year or two a year where the psychiatrist will pick up the phone and call me and say, "Hey, Mrs. Smith is just not ready now. Mrs. Smith has got this issue. She's got a, already has an addiction problem with alcohol. She hasn't told you," and so forth. "I do not believe this is ready." And so I'll communicate with Mrs. Smith and I'll say, "Listen, your psychiatrist, your psychologist thinks you're not ready. You need to do this. You need to go whatever, and we'll revisit it in 6 months. We'll revisit it in a year, and so I will not do bariatric surgery on that patient."
With the screening, I know that the psychologist, psychiatrist, a lot of it is the testing and pre-screening for the program. On the counseling side, I see less of the social work, clinical counselors, less of the actual counseling folks in the practice in the care centers. Is there a hiring trend or a difference? Do you see that changing, evolving? Is my question just too muddy?
No. I think that part of it has to do with, you know, compliance of the patient. You know, the providers are there. The mental health counselors are there before surgery and they're after surgery. We have the psychologist before and after. But, you know, a lot of times the patients, a patient who doesn't regularly see a psychologist or psychiatrist needs to see one before surgery. But after surgery, there's really no requirement unless there's a need, unless we identify it when we're seeing the patient. If I see a patient 3 months post-op, 6 months post-op, and they're struggling in regard to their mental health, I'll tell them, "Hey, you need to see your psychologist, psychiatrist." But if they don't have an issue, they don't see them. So they may not see them post-operatively because they don't have an issue with the changes and the adjustment that was been required with bariatric surgery. So that's probably why you're not seeing as much of it postoperatively as, you know, the requirement preoperatively.
That makes sense. Thank you for listening to part one of our interview with Dr. Anthony Gonzalez. In part one, we had a chance to get to know Dr. Gonzalez. We discussed the state of the U.S. and global obesity epidemic. We discussed a variety of treatments available for managing metabolic disease. And in part two, we will get Dr. Gonzalez's thoughts on engaging frontline healthcare providers, ideas to help those providers refer and manage patients, future metabolic treatments and procedures, and improving the overall quality of care for obese patients. Please remember to register for continuing medical education for listening to part one and part two. It's free to listeners. Thank you again for listening, and we hope you have found this to be of value. Please also remember to like, follow, subscribe, or otherwise show your support for our mission to raise awareness and educate healthcare professionals and patients about ways to manage the global diabetes epidemic. This episode is accredited for continuing medical education by CINEMED. Please view the accreditation information in the show notes. After listening to the episode, click the link provided in the accreditation portion of the show notes to obtain your CME. Please feel free to send us questions, comments, or show ideas you may have for future Reset Diabesity episodes. I'm your host, Dr. Rob Johnston. Thank you for listening. This podcast is sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Medtronic. The content of this podcast includes opinions of the participants and are not to be construed as medical advice. Always consult your own physician for medical guidance.